Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Back in May 2004, one of the first couple of shows we did on American Variety was with a legendary underwater treasure hunter named Bob Marks. Bob, who died in 2019 at the age of 82, was actually much more than a treasure hunter. He was by far the most prolific discoverer of ancient shipwrecks in history, having found over 5,000 shipwrecks in over 60 countries. He was a pioneer in scuba diving, a prolific author, and was best known for his work in marine archaeology. In 1962, he reenacted Christopher Columbus's voyage to the New World, an exploit for which he was actually knighted by the Spanish government. Our second show is about that, and I thought it'd be interesting to recap that show in his memory. So here goes.
You may remember a few weeks back we had a guest on the program, Bob Marks, who's a legendary treasure hunter from Indian Atlantic, Florida. And we talked then about a lot of the wrecks that he's explored and his long career. And one thing that kept coming up was all of the many different aspects of this multifaceted man's career beyond being a treasure hunter and finder. He was one of the founders of underwater archaeology back in the late 1950s. In the mid-60s, he was an explorer for several years of a sunken city off Jamaica, former pirate capital called Port Royal. Bob was an early adopter of underwater technology for deep water exploration in particular, but he was really one of the earlier users of scuba in the United States and has developed and used such things as remotely operated vehicles. He's an historian of Spanish colonization of the New World and a prolific author and lecturer, and basically an all-around explorer. One of the things that Bob touched on in our last show with him is reenactment of some of the famous voyages of discovery, like Christopher Columbus's. And Bob said, with all the many things he's done, those voyages have been the highlights of his career in his own mind. So, Bob, welcome back again.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here again.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us about some of those voyages?
I first got interested in making an ocean crossing when I saw the movie of Thor Heyerdahl on a Kon-Tiki, which came out about 1946. And I said right then, even though I was a kid, I was going to do something similar. I started working in the Spanish archives in 1959. And my real plan was to just dig up information on shipwrecks around the world and use this data. Then I got fascinated by the Spanish treasure fleets, and they sail every year for 3.5 centuries, bringing trade goods from the old world over to the new world and returning with enormous amounts of treasure. And on the way home, of course, they went right past the coast here, and the last thing they always saw was Cape Canaveral before heading for Europe. Mm-hmm. And so I raised $500,000 to build a replica of a galleon so that when I would write the books on a galleon, I decided to write a six-volume history, 1500, 1550, the first one, and on. But I kept finding dry information, like an old sea daddy or a captain, he'd go through so many hurricanes that he'd describe it in one paragraph. I went into my books to have what was life on the ship about. So to do that, I would have to build a galleon. Well, not being much of a businessman, I started building this on the north coast of Spain, and I got it half done and ran out of money.
And we're talking about a guy who's only in his late 20s at this time.
Yeah, 29. So I was very, really depressed. I couldn't do my voyage, and I climbed a hill one day, and I looked down to the next bay, and I saw a replica of Columbus's ship, the Niña. And I ran down, and I said, what are you guys doing? He said, oh, we just built this. We're going to sail it on weekends. And it took a lot of drinking with him to convince him, let's go and sail to America and show how it was done. And when I told him I had to do it completely authentic, the same food, the same navigation, everything except for camera and film was authentic. Even my logbook had to be pigskin. I used a quill. The ink was made from shark's blood. We wore the same clothes. No medicine, no radio. Nobody could smoke because tobacco hadn't been discovered. Huh. The guy who put up the money and built the ship, he thought I was out of my mind, but I finally convinced him. So we had a voyage from northern Spain to southern Spain, which I predicted would take 6 days, and it took us 29 days. We got out there in storms, fogs, etc. So it's not easy to sail a Columbus ship, a replica called the Caravel.
That was kind of the shakedown, Chris.
Shakedown. Then we got to Palos, where Columbus left for on his first voyage in 1492. And the next minute we knew the dictator Franco, he's flying in with all kind of important people to show him the ship and parties, and even Esther Williams, the swimmer, had a finca or horse ranch nearby. She threw a party. So we had a couple weeks of partying when we should have been doing all kind of repairs to the ship, and all the food, as I said, had to be authentic. So the main diet was different kinds of beans, rice, dried pork, dried fish, dried beef, fresh vegetables and fruits, which didn't last too long, and whatever we caught in the water, like fresh fish. And we had a goat on board and a couple chickens and stuff like that.
How many people in the crew?
A total of 9. So I originally had over 5,000 volunteers when people read about it or saw it on television. And with the help of psychiatrists and everything, I whittled it down to 9 of us. And I had to make myself captain because the guy who built it didn't have the remotest idea much about sailing. In fact, he told me he had been in the Spanish Navy. And then I found out later he went on one cruise and got so violently seasick they threw him out.
At least he built the boat.
And I had one Frenchman on board who was like a veterinarian in real life, so I made him the ship's doctor. I was given a Monsignor priest by the Archbishop of Pamplona, where this rich kid who built the vessel was from, because the priest had a drinking problem. Well, it was the wrong thing to put him on my ship, because instead of having stone ballast to weigh the ship down, I had 2,500 gallons of wine and 1,500 gallons of brandy. So the Padre stayed pretty well lit.
A dream come true.
And after all these parties and putting on the authentic food and all these ceremonies, Columbus took 6 days from Palos to get to Gran Canaria Island. And I knew we weren't as good as him, but I said, okay, we'll take us 12 days. Well, it took us 31 days. And when we got there, we were already out of food and water in pretty bad condition.
5 times as long.
And all the barrels had gone bad, so the water turned black. And so we had to get new barrels, and the bread turned to penicillin hard as a rock. So the people in the Grand Canary says, oh, we have the same oven used by Columbus. We'll make your bread, and we're going to give you better cast for like the water and all that kind of stuff. So we loaded up. It took Columbus 33 days from Grand Canary Island to San Salvador, Bahamas, and it took us exactly 3 days, 3 times as much. But during the voyage, it was incredible. If you have to keep in mind, this was the fall of 1962. The Earth was in really bad shape. It was the missile crisis. We're ready to nuke Cuba and Russia. And all this is going on. Of course, we don't have a radio. In fact, during that crossing in 99 days, I never saw a boat, ship, anything on the horizon. I never saw even a contrail of a plane. So we really were living the exact life of Columbus, eating the same food. We had a cat on board named Linda, meaning pretty, and unfortunately, just about every cat that I've had since in the last 40-some years, boy or girl, they all been named Linda.
Well, I hope Linda didn't turn out to be good to eat, too.
We were accused of that. Linda fell overboard right towards the end.
Sure.
So we took on all these fresh food and vegetables, but there's no room on the deck to keep it in the air, and they had to have it down in the hold. And, of course, it all went horrible after 3 or 4 days, so we were out of that. So basic every meal was like garbanzos, chickpeas, and some kind of beef or pork or something like that, 3 meals a day. But we had a lot of vino and a lot of brandy, as I said. So we sang the same songs that they did and played the same games. They had different kind of cards and chess that we play today. And it was absolutely just like being at the time, the most incredible experience of my life. So some of the guys were better than other guys. Some lied about their sailing experiences. And one of the biggest problems I had, 3 of my guys were kind of old. One told me he had been in the Navy for 48 years, and he was, but he didn't tell me that 47 and a half years he was a lighthouse keeper.
So he didn't ask the right questions.
Yes, we learned as we went, and the food kept getting less and less.
Yeah.
And I realized we're not going to make it across in 33 days. So I had to cut the rations first to 2 meals a day, then 1 meal a day. But, as I said, a lot of vino and a lot of brandy to make up for it. And we had all kind of experiences. Like, I had a whale, and it stayed with us for 4 days. And the first night, it was twice as big as the Nina, which was 39 feet long. It went underneath. I guess it was lonesome. And the heartbeat was so loud and powerful that the whole Nina was sinking, you know, like, not sinking,
vibrating.
Shaking.
Vibrating.
Vibrating.
The heartbeat.
Yeah.
Unreal.
And we saw every kind of creature that you can imagine. We had our Loch Ness monster types out there, and we weren't drunk when I saw them. You know, a giant snake so long you couldn't believe it. I had a giant octopus 70, 75 feet long. Not octopus, squid. Sorry. And when things really got bad, I started collecting plankton, deep plankton, and we start mixing salt water with the wine and the brandy, and we went into a three-week calm where it was so flat, there wasn't a cloud in the sky, and the water was blue in the sky, and you couldn't see even the horizon. So we did what they did in the old whaling ships. We went into the skiff, which we had, and we'd take turns, 15, 20 minutes, two guys trying to row.
Towing the boat.
Towing the boat, because we had no wind for 3 weeks.
Unbelievable.
But the most hair-raising was we got into five hurricanes. And the January 21st edition of Life magazine, 1963, said that these were the worst hurricanes in 100 years, and over 50 major ships, tankers, and freighters sank. We didn't. We were like a little cork. 60, 80-foot waves, we just go up and down like climbing a mountain, whereas big ships, when it would get on two crests of two big waves, with nothing in between, they break in half and sink. So by the time we were halfway across the Atlantic, they were collecting money in Spain to make monuments because everybody was convinced we died in the hurricane. And I had two wives already in court fighting over all my money. They thought I was dead, you know. So nobody expected to see us, and in those days there wasn't all this television and big soccer games and, you know, World Series and all that
stuff. Well, no cell phones, no satellites.
It was a huge event around the world, this voyage. So about 9 days before we finally got there, on day 90, out of nowhere comes two planes, and they were U.S. Navy submarine hunting planes out of Roosevelt Roads, Puerto Rico. So they were just as surprised as we were to see each other, because we were dead officially. So they dropped a device called the sonar buoy in the water, and it's a kind of a float with an antenna on the top, has a 200-foot cable with a speaker that goes down, and that's how they pick up the noise of, like, Russian submarines. I don't know what the hell it was. I'm starving, man. I jump in the water, bring it on board.
You thought there was food in it.
And it's laying there. And so I'm blasting the Navy like, you can't believe it. Here we are dying. These stupid guys dropped this thing. I'm a Marine, of course. I don't like the Navy that much.
I see.
And it went on and on and on, and the planes came back after half an hour. Guy drops like a mustard jar. There's a note. I pick it up. He says, listen, jarhead.
we
recorded everything you said. You even blasted the President of the United States. We're going to give everybody a copy. Now, you could talk to us through this device, but we can't talk to you because it's one way. So as a joke, I said, are we in the Pacific or Atlantic Ocean? Wag your wings left for Pacific and right. So they got back at me for all the bad things I said about them, because the next day around the world, the newspaper says, Captain of the Nina doesn't know what ocean he's in.
I need to take a little station break here, Bob. You're listening to American Variety Radio. And I'm your host, Court Lewis, here with my guest, Bob Marks. We're talking about his nearly unbelievable journey to reenact the journey of Christopher Columbus, which he did back in 1962. So, go ahead.
Anyhow, by the time the Navy came, we had to resort to killing sharks, catching them, and drying the shark meat out on the side, like hardtack.
Doing what now?
Catching sharks, cutting them in strips, because we ran out of firewood by this time, and hanging them on the side to dry them out.
Oh, I see.
Now, you have a thing called scurvy on a long voyage, and we had no vegetables or fruit for months. And so everybody's teeth were falling out. So I got the Monsignor, myself, and a Frenchman to collect seaweed, and we ate it. It tastes like iodine. But I saved all my teeth, and the veterinarian saved his, and the priest saved most of his. Most of the other guys lost almost all their teeth. When they bit into this hard shark meat, their teeth would stay in the meat, you know, the shark. So I've never eaten shark since. So we start making soups out of seaweed. I jump in the water and pull the barnacles off the bottom of the boat and make soup. And as I said, we collected plankton. So I tell these guys, we don't have any food or water. Navy comes back the next day, two planes. They drop nine parachutes. Eight don't open. They sink. They drop them too low. The one that I opened was pretty big cylinder. What do you think's on top? Cigarettes. We can't smoke. Columbus hadn't discovered tobacco. So all my guys wanted to kill me because I'm throwing cigarettes overboard. Then the next thing were Playboy magazines. Who the hell needs Playboy magazines? Really? You know, you're in the middle of the ocean, you know anything about women.
You're half crazy anyway.
And then they dropped life-saving kits, but guess what? They were kits for in the mountains. So the hooks for catching trout, not for catching ocean fish. And then on the bottom were these things that you blew up like big balloons for salt water conversion to fresh water. using solar evaporation.
Oh, yeah.
And you tow those behind a boat, and no sooner had we put them in the water, the sharks came and ate them. So much for that. And then the next day they came again and only dropped one parachute. This one also didn't really open, but I managed to get to it before it sank. And it was a radio, so we could have two-way communications, but the radio had been crushed, so we didn't have anything. Oh, and in that one I got flares, like road flares. Yeah. Well, we need flares out in the middle of the ocean. Yeah. And no food, no water. So we kept going towards San Salvador, and it'd fly out, and the press was out there taking pictures, and on. And we finally got to San Salvador and the Bahamas, all together, from northern Spain to southern Spain to Canaries, and this 99-day thing. We had been 6 months at sea. The subtitle of the book, I wrote two books on the voyage. One is called The Voyage of the Nina II, and the other one's Following Columbus. Should have been How I Lost 44 Pounds.
I was thinking that you could...
I lost 40, and I was thin to start with, so it was quite an experience. The flour had turned to absolute concrete. So with an axe, I chopped it into like a powder. I mixed it with rancid olive oil and salt water, and I made like Mexican tortillas. And when you're hungry, you'll eat anything.
But you did have fire, right?
We ran out of wood.
Yeah, so...
So I'm chopping a boat up to make these tortillas. I'm chopping parts of the sides up. And we had this goat that we had kept all along the voyage. And we were in love with it. I named it Pinzona after a girl I met in Palos before we left.
Well, that's attractive.
And, of course, it was eating all the canvas, eating all the rope when all the food went. By the time we finally killed it, it was nothing but blood came out of it. So we mixed the blood with rancid garlic and rancid onions. And, man, that was the best meal I ever had in my life. I mean, blood stew, let's call it.
So this is not a four-star cruise, but it's definitely a crash weight loss program. So,
finally, we spotted on Christmas Eve, 1962, the island. Everybody's greatly rejoicing. It was too late to try to get in, but we went and anchored on the lee side. And I had no idea when we got ashore there was over 200 members of the press from around the world.
San Salvador, right?
In Bahamas, yes.
It's a small island.
Tiny,
Was it even inhabited?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was a little inn there.
Okay.
Now it's a big diving resort destination.
Uh-huh.
So everybody says, what's the first thing you want? And I said, I want a big platter of pasta. And they gave me like 3 pounds of pasta. And of course, from not eating for months and months, guess what happened to the pasta?
Don't want to hear a graphic explanation.
So then I asked for a ton of ice cream. Same thing happened. So then the funny part, after a couple of days playing with the press and doing all these interviews, we actually towed the Nina to Nassau. And right then, they had just opened up Paradise Island, Huntington Hartford, who owned A&P department stores. So they invited us. Here we have 6 months of beards. We hadn't bathed forever except for saltwater baths, you know. They put us in this incredible hotels. And because it had just opened, every movie star in the world was there. And in the next room to me was Dina Morrell, who was very famous in those days.
What, an actress? Or?
Yeah, and also TV shows. And she was married at that time to a guy named Hormel, which is a big meatpacking company.
Oh, yeah?
She was very, very well known. So she decides to take me golfing the next day. I didn't know anything about golf. They had Gary Player, the South African, there.
Oh, yeah.
And after about 15 minutes, he begged me, says, Mark's, don't ever touch a golf club again. I had already broken a wood. I hit so hard, you know. And of course, I didn't hit the ball. I hit the ground.
Well, you're probably weak as a devil anyway.
Yeah. And so we were loading up on the food, especially ice cream, my brain food.
Oh.
And I eventually sold the vessel, was towed to Acapulco, was on display there for 30-some years. And then we had a ticker tape parade in New York on Wall Street. And when we went, we all went back to Spain for all kinds of ceremonies. And I was made a knight commander. It's more than just being a knight in the Order of Isabel the Catholic.
A Spanish knight.
Spanish knight, but higher, a Spanish knight commander.
I should have introduced you as Sir Robert Marks, huh?
I don't do that, but a lot of people do that.
Don't worry, I won't.
And then it was incredible to compare living on a boat like we did, you know. So now I work 6 times a year. I go on Princess Cruise Lines, P&O, which, you know, is 12 meals a day. Right. Everybody gains a pound.
Right.
And I lecture. And the first lecture I give on every day, I have 110 different lectures I give, depending where the cruise is The Voyage of the Nina II. And when it was all finished, I said, I don't want anybody coming up to me telling me they don't like the food on this ship.
That's it.
Or they're not getting enough food or anything. You see how it was for me? I don't want to hear any complaints. And that really does the trick.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, here with my guest, Bob Marks, who is a world-famous, renowned, intrepid treasure hunter and finder. And you're listening to the story of the incredible voyage of Bob Marks and his motley crew from Spain to San Salvador, reenacting Christopher Columbus's historic voyage in 1492. So at the tail end, then, how long was it before you cleaned up? I mean, were you doing all this for a day or two still with the 6 months beard and still looking extremely
got rid of
raggedy.
All that. And then Columbus came into my life about 6 years later. I was working in Jamaica on the sunken city of Port Royal, and on his fourth and last voyage he lost two ships in St. Anne's Bay on the north coast by Ocho Rios. Hmm. And so I went out and found those two ships, all excited, Columbus's ships. And the Jamaican government wouldn't let me excavate them, even though I worked for them. I was their employee. Hmm. But because they said it enhanced the beginning of slavery. It was the white guys that came over here and then brought over the Africans, you know, to be slaves. And
yeah.
We don't want to support anything to do with that.
Why'd they hire you to find them?
I actually did it on my own. I was working at Port Royal. And
oh, I see.
I just decided this is big. Good thing to do, and
I
didn't think I'd find him that easy, so I didn't ask for permission. Once I found him, of course, great news around the world, and Prime Minister shut me down.
Bob's book, The Voyage of the Niña 2, Roman numeral 2, was published in 1963, and so of course it's out of print, but you can still get it on Amazon.com. It's out of print, of course, but there are a few used copies that you can get on Amazon.com if you put in
Well, I could get it in the library, because over 650,000 copies of that book sold, so
yeah, okay,
they could get it.
They're in libraries. But if you want to have your own copy and don't want to steal it from the library, that's how you can get it. Was there another book about that voyage?
Yeah, I did one called Following Columbus, and that was a big coffee table book, mainly photos for kids that can't read. There was text, of course, and that had a couple hundred photographs in it in color showing everything, all the different aspects in it, the cat eating and playing with the cat, sleeping with the cat, all the dolphins and everything that we've saw in the water, you know. But it's incredible when you go across the whole ocean and you never see another vessel.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do that another, today. No. I mean, there's so many sea lanes with stuff going up and down.
So,
you know what's amazing to me, Bob, is that as famous as the Contiki voyage was, what was it, 5 years earlier or 10 years earlier?
1947.
Or something. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so quite a while earlier. That it sounds like this attracted all kinds of world attention at the time, but I'm surprised that it's not really well known like the Contiki voyages later. That may be because you're not as much of a self-promoter by nature and you're just out there working. I don't know. But what do you think?
Well, it was a cover story on National Saturday Evening Post, and it was in National Geographic. And I don't know. It was a big story in those days.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. I'm interested. I have to ask you about the snake-like thing you saw. Did you see it in daylight and full daylight and calm water? And
right at sundown, it was like a giant snake, well, more than a snake, like a dragon. And everybody on the vessel saw it. And the reason we saw a lot of other things besides that is we're sailing across, we're not making any noise. Even sailboats across the Atlantic have generators and they're making noise. And noise really travels underwater. And we're out there without any noise. I mean, except for our voices.
Stomach's grumbling.
And yeah, that's true. And then I couldn't photograph it because I didn't have fast enough film. On another night, I'm up on the quarter deck, and suddenly the whole ocean lit up. It was a full moon. And it was like millions of polka dots. They were about a yard across, phosphorescent, shiny. As far as you could see, so I woke everybody up in the middle of the night. I said, you guys got to see this.
This happened all of a sudden. Boom.
Yeah.
Came on.
So we got harpoons with lines attached and kept throwing them in the water trying to hit one of these. And it was like a chain reaction. All these circles disappeared, you know.
We'd go out.
Then they'd come back in formation again. And so that was a freaky. But
yeah,
the giant squid also was a big concern to, you know, different marine specialists.
Yeah, they're very seldom seen.
Yeah,
I mean, occasionally a dead one will
walk up on the beach. Because we didn't have any noise. We're just another creature out there.
I'll be darned. You know, it's hard to feature this crew of people that you collected who, as you say, were were not, in, for the most part, experienced sailors and mariners, and yet, you know, compared to Columbus's people, and you went out and took three times as long to get across and sailing this little antique boat. It's amazing you got there.
It's the weather. I mean, Columbus had full-time 33 days of trade winds. He never had a day of calm. And I had 3 weeks of pure flat calm. Then I had five hurricanes. And after each hurricane, it takes you a couple of days to make all the repairs and everything. The fifth one, it hit has ripped the rudder completely off. So we had to make a makeshift rudder.
Good Lord.
So you lose time that way.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, they were very experienced. They knew what they were doing. They'd lived their lives doing
this. Yeah,
but
they had better luck with the weather.
And they had better weather, all of that.
A lot of it.
So I'm amazed you made it, is what I'm saying. Was the navigation a real challenge?
I had an astrolabe, which you could use only for telling your latitude.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell longitude because chronometers hadn't been made. So on a ship, you know, you tell time, you have a sundown. If somebody remembers to turn it over, you know, you have more or less a rough idea of the time.
I know you did some other historic kind of reenactment voyages after that, and we just have a couple minutes, but maybe just give us a very quick overview of just a couple of those, Bob, if you can.
Right. For two different movies, the first one for Columbia called The Longship, starring Richard Widmark and a cast of thousands, I got hired to build the three 10th century Viking ships for that movie. And it was one of those stupid four-hour Hollywood movies with everything wrong in it, but I was the technical consultant. And I had it, and they actually filmed it, believe it or not, in Yugoslavia. And it came to grief off of Algeria at a time when they were shooting Americans, 1964. And we filled up in a big storm with water, and this was twice the size of the Nina, but the gunwale was very low. Got towed back to Tunisia, couldn't repair it. And so I had been collecting all along that voyage for 6 weeks, Phoenician, Greek, Roman, all kind of artifacts in every port that we went along the thing. So when they wouldn't let us go out of the country till we disposed of the boat, the mast had also been broken. I got a couple of local fishermen. I said, tow me out, bring two 55-gallon drums of gasoline, and I'm going to give it a Viking funeral. So we go out, drop the anchor, and put the mast up, put the sail up, as much as we could. The vessel caught on fire. The anchor line burnt first. And here went a flaming 10th century replica Viking ship for the biggest oil refinery in the world. That was in Biarritz. And, of course, we went to jail. But the vessel sunk with all those goodies on it. So some archaeologist is going to find a 10th century Viking ship with goodies going back to, like, 1500 B.C. Phoenician.
Well, meanwhile, you know, for our listeners, the context of all of this is that Bob, 7 days a week, practically 20 hours a day, was finding wrecks and diving on wrecks and bringing up treasure and salvaging them. And so these adventures were done in the context of kind of side jobs, side activities with all of that. You've been listening to American Variety Radio with Court Lewis, my guest, intrepid explorer and treasure hunter finder, Bob Marks.
And as always, thanks so much for listening to American Variety and to this public radio station. We sure couldn't do it without you. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.